He played Barack Obama to help Mitt Romney prepare for his debates, and he smuggled a kayak into China to paddle the Yangtze River. Today on Uncommon Knowledge, one of the most intriguing figures in American public life, the junior senator from Ohio, Rob Portman. Shooting today on the campus of Dartmouth College, Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A member of the Dartmouth College class of 1978 and a graduate of the University of Michigan Law School, Rob Portman is now the junior senator from Ohio. Senator Portman represented part of Cincinnati in the House of Representatives from 1999 to 2005, that is for six consecutive terms. From 2005 to 2006, he served as the United States Trade Representative in the administration of President George W. Bush. And from 2006 to 2007, he served as Director of the Office of Management and the Budget, also in the administration of President George W. Bush. A member of the Ledyard Canoe Club here at Dartmouth, Senator Portman has kayaked the Yangtze River in China and completed the full 1,900-mile length of the Rio Grande River here in the United States. Senator Portman, welcome.
Peter, good to be with you.
Obamacare. Two quotations. Here's quotation one. President Obama announcing just last month that 8 million Americans have now enrolled in the Affordable Care Act. Quote, the repealed debate is over. The Affordable Care Act is working. I recognize that Republicans are going through the stages of grief, anger, denial, all that stuff. They're not at acceptance yet. Close quote. Quotation two, Senator Rob Portman. It's a failed model, and we need to get rid of it. Close quote. Now, you are sure that you just haven't reached acceptance yet?
You know, it's not about grief. It's about concern for our constituents. And by the way, of those 8 million, the question is, you know, how many of those folks didn't previously have insurance? It appears that that's about 25% of them. That's based on a RAND study. We don't know, by the way, because the administration refuses to offer us the information. They aren't being transparent about it. Second, the question is how many of those folks have actually paid and are part of the system. But I have never thought that the website wouldn't be figured out. It was a shock to me that they were as incompetent as they were in getting it up and going. I've always thought this is an issue of cost and of choice, giving people the ability to have the coverage they want for themselves and for their family. And that's why this is a failed model, because it does require people to leave what they have, sometimes a doctor or a hospital system that they want. And it doesn't deal with the fundamental problem in our healthcare system, which is the fact that we have skyrocketing costs. I was with two small business owners recently visiting their factories in Ohio, and both said the same thing, which is we're looking at double-digit increases again in our healthcare costs, same as we had last year. We simply can't sustain this. We're going to have to change our program, or what I think many businesses are saying, maybe get out of the healthcare business altogether.
Just dump them into the government.
And allow the government to pick it up with these higher costs. So. This is a failed model, and the good news is there's a different model.
Okay, I want to come to, first, sort of a premise here. Mike Gerson, former speechwriter to George W. Bush, writing in the Washington Post, quote, conservatives need to let this sink in. America already has a right to a certain minimum of health treatment, close quote. So the implication there is you can't just repeal. You need to repeal and replace with something pretty substantial. Do you buy that premise, that we have, in effect, a right to health care?
I buy the premise that there was already a system where if somebody comes into an emergency room, they get treatment. It's not the most efficient way to get treatment. That's why we want to encourage people to get access to insured health care. And we can do that, and we can lower costs. And we can do it through a couple of different ways. One is the competitive model that we talk about a lot as Republicans, which I think is absolutely true, that in the healthcare system you don't have the normal competition for cost and quality.
Right.
And since we're here at Dartmouth College, and by the way, I'm getting hives being back in a library at Dartmouth College. I mean, I didn't spend much time here, but yeah, actually not. I probably should have. But there's a group here looking at this very issue. You know, why do we pay 50% more than any other developed country in the world, and twice what many developed countries pay for health care when we still have 40 to 50 million Americans uninsured? And part of it is we don't have this competitive model where we know what the cost and quality is, so that doctors and healthcare systems should be able to provide us that information. And second, we have got to, you know, re-engage with what has always worked in America to get costs down, and that's giving people choice rather than mandates. And I think those are sort of, to me, the fundamental building blocks for a better healthcare system. So you should be able to buy insurance across state lines.
Okay, final question on healthcare. Let's suppose, you and I would be given to hoping this in any event, but let's stipulate that in November, Republicans retain the House and get to 51 seats in the Senate. Mm-hmm. Your party, for the first time since you've been in the Senate, controls the Senate. Repeal of Obamacare would remain out of the question because the President of the United States would veto any such measure. But you'd have 2 years before Barack Obama left office in which you, the Republicans, would control both houses of Congress. What can you do in those 2 years to advance your agenda of health care?
Have a healthy debate with the American people and with the President, because we hopefully will send legislation to his desk about alternatives. It should never be about repeal, it should be about replace. This system that the President has put in place hasn't worked by his own metrics, his own measures. The Congressional Budget Office, by the way, has told us that after 10 years of Obamacare, still 30 million Americans would be uninsured. Costs will skyrocket, and it'll have a negative impact on jobs. 2.5 million people lose their jobs because of the way Obamacare works. So clearly this model is not the right one. So our job, if we do get the majority, is to take on a very important, solemn responsibility, and that's to govern, and that's to let the American people know we do have alternatives, and not just on health care, as you and I will talk about, but on how we do with our regulatory system, our tax code, how we ensure we expand exports, how we, as Republicans, have better ideas on reducing the debt and deficit and growing this economy. So I think that's our job, Peter. We can't just say no. We have to say we have a better way, which we do.
But those, let's say those 2 years, again, supposing you take the Senate, those 2 years between taking the Senate and a new president coming into office are a time when American health care can get substantially fixed? You believe you could send legislation to the White House the president would sign? Or this is a time fundamentally for debate, for shaping the issue? We live in a presidential system. We have to wait for the next president for real action. Which of those two seems
like? As a practical matter, I think you're right. The president would veto anything we sent to him. Right. But having said that, let's not be shy about sending him something. Right. Because that ultimately is where the American people are going to see the contrast between our vision for a healthcare system where you do have cost containment, but also more choice and therefore higher quality, and the president's system, which is a one-size-fits-all government program that imposes these mandates. So let's allow that debate to flourish by doing something in the House and in the Senate, should we get the majority, putting it on the agenda, which will be the big difference, is that we'll be able to control that agenda and be able to let the American people know there is a difference and there is a better way.
Okay, the budget, long-term view of the budget. During 8 years in office, your president, George W. Bush, oversaw a total increase in spending of more than 80%, the biggest, far larger than Bill Clinton's 32%, and the biggest increase since President Lyndon Johnson. He's fighting two wars, grant that. Subtract defense spending, subtract debt service, and you still see the biggest increase in spending since Nixon, more than 5% a year. How could that have happened under a Republican president? How is it that the budget of the United States seems so much on autopilot that even Republicans find themselves spending and spending and spending?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think the president should have vetoed appropriations bill sooner. When he started to do that, when I was at the Office of Management and Budget, you found that, in fact, that spending was curtailed on the part that the president and the Congress controls.
I know you didn't get into the White House until 2006, which is 6 years after things got started, but was it a calculation in the Bush administration? We have a war to fight. The defense of the republic is the imperative. If the price of fighting that war is letting them spend like a bunch of drunken sailors on domestic matters, let them spend as long as they support us on the war. Was there some kind of calculation like that, do you suppose?
Well, I do think there was some of that thinking. It wasn't just about the wars. It was about protecting the country. Remember, after 9/11, there had to be additional expenditures, substantial expenditures,
large expenditures
on Homeland Security.
Right.
Intelligence, you know, sort of hardening the country. So it was more than just military. It was a whole new way of looking at the world as a very dangerous place. And there was probably some of that. There was also the reality, Peter, that at that time about 60% of the budget was on autopilot, and that was the fastest growing part, and that was the so-called entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Now that's, by the way, two-thirds of the budget. In 10 years, it'll be three-quarters of the budget. So when you look at the spending in terms of what the president and Congress controls, you look at the domestic discretionary part, which is shrinking, again, about one-third of the budget now, soon to be 25% of the budget. And on that part, after 2006, the president started to make progress because he started vetoing legislation. He hadn't vetoed a bill until 6 years into his term. When he did that, then suddenly Congress stopped passing these increases in the domestic spending.
You were a director for the Office of Management of the Budget a little over a year. Fundamentally, one budget belonged to you, the budget for fiscal year 2008, which included a deficit of $459 billion, more than twice the deficit of the year before. Now, let's stipulate that a loyal Republican and a man who served in a president's administration is not going to be too critical of his president. But would it be accurate to say that you were unhappy with the budget that you had to put forward?
Well, actually, that would reflect the budget from the year before. The one I put forward...
I've got this wrong. Good. Fix it for me.
The one I put forward, which I put forward a year before, was the one that actually proposed a balanced budget, not over 10 years, but over 5 years. Imagine that. And I insisted on that. And, you know, it was the president's budget, not my budget. But we worked internally to work through some differences on that. But we actually proposed, in the one budget that I was able to propose, a balanced budget. And we did it through taking some tough decisions. In fact, some that weren't very politically popular, including some reforms in the Medicare program, so-called means testing in Medicare, meaning that if you're above a certain income, in that case about 170 grand as a couple, you don't get the same benefits under Part B and Part D in terms of the government paying for your premiums. You have to pay for them. And that was the first time that had been proposed in a budget. That balanced budget over 5 years, of course, was met by the Democratic Congress, because remember, the Democrats were in charge with kind of a laugh, and they did their own budget. The president then vetoed appropriations bills, and then they just did continuing resolution spending from the year before. But that's how my team should be judged, is, you know, what did we put forward and what happened?
Well, what I'm trying to tease out here is I is partly your role in the Senate today. I get the feeling, Senator, that you don't have any hesitation at all to take on members of your own party in matters of budget. There are certain fights you actually like. Is that fair?
Yeah, sure. And as I said, you know, I said at the time and repeating today, the president should have vetoed appropriations bills sooner. I believed a balanced budget was the right way to go, and there was an internal fight on that at the White House. I was able to prevail on that barely, and that set a template going forward. So the Democrats always wanted to spend more, Republicans wanted to spend less, but I think we needed to have a balanced budget. And by the way, Paul Ryan's budget that I supported last go around, and that he will once again, be proposing for next fiscal year, balances in 10 years, and that's important too. It's harder to balance in 5 years now because we are so much deeper in debt and deficit. The current president will have added more debt held by the public than every other president in the history of the country combined this year, and so it's all relative, I suppose. But I think the balanced budget is really important, Peter, because it gives you something to push against.
Right.
That's why 49 states have it. That's why our local communities have it, and that's what we need at the federal level.
Longer term view here. Bill Vogley published a book 2 years ago called The American Welfare State, and this is the arresting statistic in that on average, entitlements since 1940 have grown at twice the rate of average income in this country. Even under Ronald Reagan, spending on welfare slowed but was not reversed. Here's Bill Vogley, quote, liberal victories advance liberalism. Conservative victories only postpone liberalism. We have 3/4 of a century of lived American experience, Senator, that prove you're on the losing side.
There's a better way. And again, as I mentioned earlier, if we do get the majority, we have to propose that better way. And it does include reform of the important, vital safety net programs, entitlement programs. But if they're not reformed, Peter, they will collapse of their own weight. They are crowding out all other government spending. They will bankrupt the country if we don't deal with them. And so this is why, as tough as it is politically, you know, they call it the third rail of the American political system. You grab it in the subway system in New York and you electrify yourself. It has to be addressed. And it includes Social Security, by the way, not just Medicare and Medicaid. And there are smart ways to do it. And there are ways to make slight adjustments now that avoid major dislocation. If you don't do it, which is what the Democrats are proposing, you continue this spiral, and it is unsustainable. That's not an ideological statement. That's
just
a statement
math.
Of fact. That's a, that's a statement
so
of fact.
So one last question here, just about how a working politician does this. You and I have a friend, also a Dartmouth man, John Hoven, member of the Senate from North Dakota. And since he's a friend, I asked him what it was like his first 6 months in the Senate. He'd been governor of North Dakota for more than a decade. And he said, well, to be honest, here's what it's like to be in the Senate. From the time I get to the office until the time I get home, I have meetings with constituents. Delegations come here from North Dakota, and they all say the same thing. They all say, Senator, we're right with you when you talk about cutting the budget. Now, look, there's this one aspect of the farm bill, right?
Yeah.
The detailed day by day, meeting by meeting pressure on you guys to spend a little more here and spend a little more. How do you resist that? What do you, as a functional matter as serving in the United States Senate, how do you resist that?
Well, it's our responsibility as senators to tell people the truth, and the truth is the current trajectory is unsustainable. You cannot raise taxes fast enough, even if you wanted to, and I don't want to be able to deal with the increase in the spending side. It's a spending issue, not a revenue issue. Over the next 10 years, actually, revenue as a percent of the economy, which is how you ought to look at it, mm-hmm. is going to be at historically high levels, and even so, we'll have historically high debts and deficits. We already have a debt of over $17 trillion. You know, we're going to have interest payments alone of almost $1 trillion 10 years from now, according to the, again, nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. So what you tell folks is this just is not sustainable. And when you do that and explain to it, I think, you know, most constituents get it, and they get that if they're coming to you with their hand out, they better have a really good way to pay for it by eliminating government spending somewhere else, or an argument that this is money well spent to be able to reduce spending somehow. So I think there is an opportunity for us to do that. But second, getting back to the conversation we had about 2014 and 2016, leadership at the level of the White House, whoever the occupant of the Oval Office is critical, because you have to have somebody explaining to the American people with that big megaphone that there is a way for us to deal with our problems, protect the country, meet our basic responsibilities to our citizens, and yet get this debt and deficit under control. And part of it requires, in my view, having that balanced budget as almost a backstop to push against, because that enables you to say to that person coming in, whether in John Hoeven's case, who, by the way, was a very popular former governor of North Dakota and a great legislator, look, you know, we have to have a balanced budget just like we do in the state of North Dakota. So when you came to see me as governor, I had to tell you, I have to prioritize. Right. I can't spend more here unless I spend less somewhere else. That's the requirement that's needed.
You're running a control, very, very seldom does politics provide a kind of control experiment, but the state of Ohio is a mixed state. Cleveland trends Democratic, Cincinnati trends Republican. You've got all kinds of complicated constituency groups in between. And the senior senator from Ohio, your colleague, Sherrod Brown, year after year after year, either wins outright or ties rankings as the most liberal member of the United States Senate. Your conservative rankings are never lower than 70 and often in the 80s. So you're called the moderate right, but the word right is always attached to you. Mm-hmm. How does that happen, that Ohio produces Sherrod Brown and Rob Portman?
Yeah, because we are a microcosm of the country. Ohio's an amazing state. We have every part of America represented. We have big cities, we have a huge agricultural sector, our biggest sector is agriculture. We have part of Appalachia. We have, as you know, lots of manufacturing, but also lots of technology and universities that are world-renowned. So it's a great state to represent, but it's very diverse. And we are absolutely purple. You know, you've got your blue shirt on today, sort of a red tie. Combine those two, and that's Ohio. So George Bush won it twice. Barack Obama won it twice.
You won in 2010. You defeated your Democratic opponent by 57-39%. 2 years later, your friend Mitt Romney lost Ohio to Barack Obama by 2 points, 50-48%. What did Mitt Romney fail to learn from you?
Oh, gosh. Well, first, I ran in a midterm cycle, and probably it was a better year to run. So much of this, I think, is affected by what the larger political trends are.
Right.
I think Mitt Romney would have been a terrific president, because I think you need somebody who, again, is a truth teller and is an executive and understands how to work with Congress and get things done. I think he would have been that president. I think President Obama has been a great disappointment in that regard. Great campaigner, mm-hmm. but hasn't made that transition from campaigning to governing. I think if you look at the polling data and you try to analyze what happened in Ohio and for that matter in other states like Florida, Virginia, where it was very close, I think the economic message that I believe is so critical to Ohio, in other words, prosperity, upward mobility, How do you get your state back on track? In our case, manufacturing is very important. I think we didn't explain that in a way that people thought it affected them and their families. Okay. And I think that was the biggest concern. And then finally, I think there's sort of a compassion gap. And I think our party needs to talk more about not just the broader economic issues, tax reform, regulatory relief, all the things that you and I believe in, but also how do you help those folks who are in communities who need help badly, and how do you ensure you have that hand up when it's necessary?
So let's talk about what the GOP has to offer. Political scientist Larry Sabato, quote, "The nation isn't going back to the GOP heyday of the 1980s, two terms for Ronald Reagan, one term for George H.W. Bush. In those days, whites were 85% of the national electorate." So there have been several deep changes since the 80s, since you were volunteering as an advance man for George H.W. Bush back in 1980. And Sabato named one, the demographic change. From 85% of the electorate in the 1980s, whites fell to 72% in 2008 and will have fallen below 70% by 2016. Democrats command the support in poll after poll of from 70 to 90% of African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. This is just mathematically overwhelming for the GOP. Either the GOP finds a way of appealing to Hispanics, African Americans, Asians, or the GOP may do well in certain places, but as a national party is finished. So how does the GOP appeal to the new Americans?
Larry Sabato is a very smart guy, but I reject that premise because, again,
boom, back of the hand, all right.
A plan for opportunity and hope.
Tell us about this. Tell us about
appeals
this.
To all groups. And, you know, it's something that in the African American community, there are people right now who are saying, gosh, what's happened in the last 5 years? We now have higher unemployment, higher poverty rates, concern about a number of issues, including the drug issue, the addiction issue, the impact on African-American communities, including prisoner reentry and reform efforts where I've taken a lead. Republicans have some really great answers to be able to help in not just the African-American community, the Hispanic community, the Asian-American community, the white community, as he talks about. I don't see the distinction between those communities in the way that Larry does. I think we have a message of hope and opportunity. We need to do a better job communicating. We need to show up. And I think if you look at what's happened again in the last 5 years, income is down about $4,000 on average per family. Poverty rates are up. We saw the unemployment figures recently, and they were relatively better. But what they didn't say, when you dig deeper, you find is that more and more people have left the workforce altogether. Long-term unemployment is at record levels.
So there's another deep difference from the 1980s. When Ronald Reagan ran and was able to appeal to the Reagan Democrats, the Reagan Democrats had jobs. Mm-hmm. They had pretty good jobs. They were factory workers. Detroit was still functioning. There was a big threat from Japan, but Detroit was still functioning. Your steel mills in Ohio were still functioning. Toledo, Ohio was still supplying the automotive industry. And now, a lot of those jobs are being performed in China. You just mentioned that we now have long-term unemployment and something that hasn't been seen in decades, which is people dropping a shrinking labor force. Mm-hmm. Let me just put it this way. What does the party of a rich, highly educated, polished, smooth, well-spoken man like Mitt Romney have to say to people in Appalachia who are on food stamps, or in Toledo, where the grandfather had a great job for the spark plug company, but they're not supplying Detroit anymore because those jobs are in Alabama or China? What does the Republican Party have to say to people who used to be Reagan Democrats and are now just hard up?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be that way. That's what the Republican Party says. And that we have a specific plan to give the economy the shot in the arm, to do what John F. Kennedy used to talk about, which is a rising tide lifting all boats. And it can happen, and it's time tested. So, you know, some Republicans, Peter, say Washington's doing too much, Washington should just get out of the way. And I certainly agree with that in terms of some regulations and so on. But Washington isn't doing what it ought to be doing to reform these basic institutions of our economy. So our tax reform system is so antiquated, so screwed up, so inefficient that we are losing jobs every day to other countries. If we reform the tax code, by the way, we're the only country among the major countries that hasn't done that since the 1980s. In fact, on the international side, not since the 1960s. I mean, we're behind on trade. We should be exporting much more, and we should be much tougher on unfair imports coming in. And on energy, we have a huge opportunity right now to develop the resources in the ground in America to be able to make us energy independent and bring back more of those manufacturing jobs. It's starting to happen. And you mentioned Ohio and manufacturing in Toledo. We may have the biggest campus at the Jeep plant in Toledo of any car campus in America by the end of this year. We're bringing jobs back from Mexico for northern Ohio, and not the Toledo area, but the Cleveland area. And you know, that's the Ford Motor Company.
It's jobs, it's growth.
And we can do it. And there are things that this president refuses to do, whether it's simple reforms of the tax code, which would make a huge difference, or backing off on some of these regulations that make no sense, that have no cost-benefit analysis that makes any sense, or whether it's dealing...
XL Pipeline?
Of course, XL Pipeline. Bill. That's sort of a no-brainer. I mean, that's 42,000 jobs right there, direct and indirect, and we should do it immediately. Energy production on public lands and the ability to go on the outer continental shelf gives us enormous opportunities to become sort of the Saudi Arabia, not just on natural gas as we are already, but on oil. And we have a huge opportunity here if we do the right things. And it doesn't take an ideological battle to win these. In other words, it's not all about us saying there's only one Republican way. A lot of this can be bipartisan.
Right.
I mean, you look at the regulatory relief and the tax reform ideas. These are ideas that if Democrats want to, you know, continue to appeal to those same working class voters you're talking about, they better be for it too, because if we communicate it better and people understand this is essential to their jobs, their future, their benefits as workers, I think this can be something we can get done. And you need a president to lead. You need somebody who understands it's a time in our country where we have serious problems. We have a crisis in certain areas. I would say one certainly is in terms of our tax system, our regulatory system. We need to act, and if we do act, we can actually make a big difference in people's lives.
Last question about these deep changes since the 80s. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, 1965, he writes a report entitled, this is the language that was used in those days, "The Negro Family, A Case for National Action," close quote. Listen to this from 1965. "The fundamental problem is that of family structure. The Negro family in the urban ghettos is crumbling. A middle-class group has managed to save itself, but for vast numbers of the unskilled and poorly educated, the fabric of conventional social relationships has all but disintegrated. So long as this situation persists, the cycle of poverty and disadvantage will continue to repeat itself," close quote. Moynihan writes that in 1965, when the illegitimacy rate among African Americans was 25%. Today, the illegitimacy rate among whites is 36%. Among Hispanics, more than 50%. And among African Americans, more than 72%. Tax reform, balance the budget, economic growth. What does any of it matter if the American family collapses?
First, they're related, because one of the reasons you have this situation is that there's not the economic growth in those communities that would enable people to form families and to be able to be successful. Another issue I work a lot on, as you know, is drug addiction. And the drug addiction issue is much broader than just our urban centers or even our poor rural communities. It's everywhere, but it affects those communities disproportionately. I actually have done some reading recently about this issue because I'm very interested in how it connects with prison reform. And one of the ways it connects, frankly, is there are fewer men in a lot of those communities who are available to be married and to be part of the family fabric because they are in prison.
They're all locked up.
And a lot of them who come out of prison end up right back in the system again. About half of them or more come out of the system. Within 2 or 3 years, they're back in the system. The nexus between addiction and prison, unfortunately, is very real. So between 60 and 70% of those people have a drug problem not dealt with. That's one reason they get back into a life of crime and back into prison. So this is all related. And what I said earlier was, it is about growing the economy. John Kennedy was right. It's about a rising tide lifting all boats. But it's more than that. You've also got to deal with some of these discrete problems. And as I said earlier, a hand up is required. And part of that hand up is having Republicans working together with Democrats. It shouldn't be a partisan issue to deal with, for instance, the heroin addiction problem today, which is taking 5 or 6 lives in Ohio every day, which is building on the prescription drug problem, which is building on other addiction problems. And if you don't deal with that issue, it's tough to get at the issue of this revolving door in prison. It's tough to get at this family issue. And then we've also got to, you know, we've got to stand for strong families across the board, because you're right, it is the building block of our society that is missing too much in some of these communities. And that requires leadership, even beyond any federal program or or you know any federal funding. It's part of who we are as a country to encourage families. But I do think this is an issue that as Republicans too often we ignore. And we need to spend more time in the inner cities and in poor rural areas, and we need to understand these communities better, but also offer some hope. Mm. And I was the author of the Second Chance Act, which is, I think, entirely consistent with a fiscal conservative philosophy, because by the way, it's between $25,000 and $40,000 a year to incarcerate these folks, rather than having them be in this high recidivism, as it's called, getting back into prison, mm-hmm. get them back into society as productive members of society and taxpayers. That's much better for all of us. It's certainly better for those families, for those communities, and for them to achieve their God-given abilities. So I think these are all issues, Peter, that are related, and there's no reason the Republican Party shouldn't be involved in them.
Last couple of questions. Politics and the good life. When you and I were students at Dartmouth College...
In the dark ages.
In the dark ages. The Cold War was still taking place. I can remember bull sessions in dorm rooms late into the night talking about politics. Politics mattered in those days. Politics was serious. There was something at stake. You may have been the only one who followed through on it, but all of us thought that having a seat in the United States Senate would be a very fine thing. You could do something with it. Now we come to the millennials. And what do current students see in politics? Dysfunction, screaming, shouting, nothing gets done at Washington, in Washington. And it's not all that clear. I now live in Northern California, where very much in the air is the idea, it's not all that clear either that it can be fixed or really that it matters. Write it off. Politics is a dead weight on the community. What you should do is ignore it and start a company of your own. What would you advise students at Dartmouth College today? Just ignore the political system, for goodness sake. Don't waste your time. Go start a company. Create jobs.
I met with 50 Dartmouth students yesterday, and by the way, pretty good turnout on about a week's notice, and they came to talk about politics. And I've got a couple interns coming to my office this summer from Dartmouth, and what I told the students was two things. One, yeah, do start that business. In fact, do something other than law school and political science. Get some experience, and then get into government and politics, mm-hmm. because the more experience you have in the real world, and you know, the more connection you have, particularly to how to create jobs and opportunity to get the country back on track, the better. But I also told them, look, you know, it affects your life in really fundamental ways. And for young people, it's particularly serious because if they don't get involved and engage, they will be hurt. Obamacare is something that I think most young people need to focus on more because the basic theory, as you know, of the Obamacare structure is that younger, healthier people will be paying for older people and sicker people.
Rip off the kids to pay for the geezers.
It's a generational theft again. Right. And then, of course, the debt and deficit. You know, young people should care a lot about it because they're carrying about $40,000, not just their student debt that they're carrying, but $40,000 of the federal government's debt when they graduate. That's what it is now. And I say that because it's their taxes that will eventually have to pay this when you get to interest payments of close to $1 trillion a year within the next decade. And then finally, I talked about the economy and jobs. They should care a lot about the fact that unemployment among young people, you know, 18 to 25, is well over twice the national average now. It's about 15% when you average it out. And, you know, half the kids getting out of college can't find a job that matches their degree. So these are all issues they should care a lot about for their own self-interest.
Right.
But finally, for the sake of the country, we need good people involved in this business of politics. You know, it's frustrating. I don't always like it. As you know, I've talked about the frustrations that I feel, but ultimately, it's honorable in the sense that you're trying to represent your neighbors and the people who live in your state or your district or your city. There's no greater honor than that. And, you know, taking it seriously, doing it for the right reasons is, you know, ultimately what this country was built on, which is a republic and, you know, therefore you representing your people and voting their interests, whether it's in the national level or the state or local level. So, as frustrating as it is, I hope more young people understanding the importance of it get engaged and involved. And finally, there is hope. There's opportunity here to make changes that can help people in their daily lives.
It can be fixed.
It certainly can be. We need a new approach where it's not a matter of compromising. It's a matter of finding common ground on some of these issues we talked about today. To give the economy the shot in the arm, we're going to have to make fundamental reforms to a lot of our institutions of our economy. We've got to do a better job of helping people who are in some of these communities that are finding a lack of hope, a lack of opportunity to pull them up, as we talked about today. But as a country, we've got to come together more. And we're too polarized now. The president has not helped. They say he's the most polarizing president in the history of our country. We need to figure out a way to come together as a country and solve these problems.
Last question, now that you're talking about the president. Just a couple of months ago, Larry Sabato wrote a column in which he named his favorite Republican presidential candidate for 2016. You.
Quote.
Really? Oh, you missed this?
I didn't think I was his favorite, but
quote. Americans tire of their incumbent presidents and often choose a very different successor with dissimilar characteristics. Portman is all steak and no sizzle. Close quote. So, Senator, listen to this list. Harvard produced the Adamses and the Roosevelts, Princeton, Madison, and Wilson, Yale, the Bushes, and Clintons. Here we sit at Dartmouth College. Do you feel the urge to make an announcement?
We produced Dr. Seuss here, didn't we? I mean, you know, so we did something good for the world. No, I didn't mean that I didn't think Larry had me as his favorite candidate because my sense was what he was saying was I'm sort of the anti-Obama in the sense of, you know, more experience.
That's pretty
and
good.
So on.
That's a place to start.
I didn't think that meant he was his favorite. But, you know, Larry also made the point in his column that I took this position on same-sex marriage.
Right.
Which puts
you are
me
in favor of same-sex marriage. It was a reversal.
It's a reversal of my previous position, and it puts me at odds with my party in many respects. I believe it's a conservative position. I came to it because my son came to me and said, to my surprise and my wife's surprise, that he was gay. We had a conversation for about a year about it. And after considering what he told me and, you know, talking to a lot of folks who are involved in this issue, I was never, frankly, involved in it, and maybe I should have been, but I never really thought deeply about it. That it seems to me that to the extent it's not a choice, which is what I believe, that as Republicans, you ought to treat people as they are. And I certainly think, you know, my God is a God of mercy and justice and grace and acceptance. And so I'm very sort of reconciled with my position on this, which is that my son and others who are gay and lesbian ought to be able to lead their lives as my wife and I have, and for 28 years now, been in a you know, had the joy and stability of a marriage. As we talked about, we want more families. So that position probably puts me at odds with some in my party because I was the first Republican senator to take that position. I think it's the right position. Again, I think it's the right conservative position in terms of individual liberty and in terms of stronger families and in terms of treating people as they are.
But Rob Portman, the practical politician, says I'm not running in 2016.
Well, that probably makes it difficult for me to win a primary election at the national level. But we'll see. I mean, I look at this, this, you know, maybe too simple, but I look at this very simply, which is if someone else steps up and can do the sorts of things that I believe our country needs desperately at this moment, I think the country's in trouble. And it's not just the fiscal situation, which obviously is on a train wreck and to bankrupt the country. It's some of the issues you talked about, some of these communities that are falling behind. It's the fact that our economy continues to be too weak to be able to hold those communities up and to have America have its rightful place in the world, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, but that's another important distinction between where we are now and where we were 20 years ago, is that America's role in the world has been diminished to the point that we can't be the country that encourages stability and democracy and freedom rights, freedom and human rights that Ronald Reagan talked about with his peace through strength, which is the right way to go, as your pen says.
Exactly, not my Reagan pen.
So I think if someone else steps up and has these ideas to be able to reform our economic system, have the Republican Party be a bigger tent party to be able to reach these communities that we talked about earlier, then I'll stay in the United States Senate, which is what I plan to do. But I'll be watching it and seeing who runs and what happens.
Let the record show, let Larry Sabato note, that was not a no. That was not a no.
Well, at this point, I'm planning to run for re-election in the United States Senate from Ohio.
Rob Portman, Dartmouth College class of 1978, junior senator from Ohio, and one of the most genuinely accomplished men in American life. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be with you.
At Dartmouth College, for the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.